Hi, everyone. It's Katie. Before today's episode of America's Most Infamous Crimes, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
This is Crime House.
In the fall of 1984, hundreds of people in one small Oregon town started getting violently sick, and nobody could pinpoint why. It would take a year, a fugitive, and a silent guru finally opening his mouth to reveal the truth. They had been poisoned on purpose, and the woman behind it was willing to do whatever it took to keep her grip on power. Every crime tells a story about the people involved, the system that tried to stop it, and the nation that couldn't look away. Some cases are so shocking, so deeply woven into who we are, that decades later, we're still asking, how did this happen? I'm Katie Ring, and this is America's Most Infamous Crimes. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'll take you deep into cases that have a lasting imprint on society and still haunt us today. Crime House exists because of listeners like you. Want even more? Join Crime House Plus and get all three parts of each week's America's Most Infamous Crime Stories dropped at once every Monday and ad-free. You'll also get the rest of the Crime House lineup ad-free and early in exclusive bonus episodes. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you listen on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of the America's Most Infamous Crime show page. This is our third and final episode on the cult known as the Rajneesh Movement. Today, I'll get into their plot to take over an entire county, how it all fell apart, and where things stand today. It started slowly in the third week of September 1984. In the Dalles, Oregon, people started turning up at doctors' offices and the local hospital with the same miserable symptoms. First came the stomach cramps and the chills, followed by a fever, vomiting, and diarrhea. At first, it looked like a run-of-the-mill stomach bug going around, but it kept spreading, and it kept getting worse. Within days, there were dozens of cases, then hundreds. Doctors who might normally see a case of food poisoning here and there were suddenly dealing with a flood of them. There wasn't any rhyme or reason to it either. Usually, you could trace it back to a single source. But the people getting sick had eaten at restaurants all over town. What investigators didn't realize yet was that the illnesses were coming in two distinctive waves, roughly a week apart in September, a pattern that pointed to two separate rounds of contamination and a deliberate strike. By the time it was over, 751 people had been poisoned. Thankfully, nobody died, but to this day, it remains the largest bioterror attack in American history. Although in the fall of 1984, nobody knew it was an attack at all. The Wasco County Health Department launched an investigation, and so did the state and federal Centers for Disease Control. Health workers fanned out, interviewing patients about everywhere they'd been and everything they'd eaten, trying to find the one thing they all had in common. They collected stool samples, pulled food from kitchens, and tested it. They were all sick from the same strand of salmonella. And the trail kept leading to the same place, the salad bars at 10 different restaurants around town. The question was, how did it get there? And this is where the Rajneeshis got incredibly lucky, because investigators reached the wrong conclusion. Salmonella is one of the most common causes of food poisoning on Earth. It shows up constantly in undercooked meat and food that's been handled badly. So when investigators looked at a salmonella outbreak across a bunch of restaurants, the explanation that made sense was the ordinary one: sloppy food handling. Maybe workers weren't washing their hands, or maybe the same supplier had delivered tainted produce to them all. The CDC's report essentially blamed the restaurant staff and recommended better hygiene and testing for food handlers. And it's not like this conclusion came out of nowhere. Investigators went through the restaurant's food suppliers, hunting for a common shipment that could explain all 10 outbreaks at once. They even tested the town's water supply, but everything came back clean. There was no contaminated delivery, No broken cooler, no single bad ingredient that tied it all together. In hindsight, that absence was itself a giant clue. A natural outbreak usually has a source you can find. But without a better theory on the table, the careless cook's explanation was the only reasonable one they could work with. A few locals weren't buying it, though. Some residents in the Dalles, including at least one person tied to the county committee that had spent years battling the commune, quietly wondered whether the Rajneeshis were behind it. The timing was hard to ignore. A mass poisoning in the county's biggest town just weeks before an election the cult was desperate to win. But suspicion isn't evidence. Nobody could connect it to the ranch. The health authorities had already pointed the finger at the restaurant workers, and the rumors went nowhere. Years later, one of the investigators admitted that there had been enormous pressure to land on a cause that wouldn't scare people. With hundreds of people sick, the public wanted an answer. And the cooks were careless was an easier pill to swallow than someone deliberately poisoned you. Now, the final report didn't completely slam the door on that possibility. It acknowledged the contamination could have been intentional. But there was no evidence pointing anywhere in particular and no real precedent for it. So the working theory stayed the ordinary one, and the recommendation was easy to follow. Make sure food handlers wash up and test clean before going back to work. And the people who'd actually done it watched the whole thing blow over. To Ma and Aunt Sheila, it probably seemed like everything was going to plan. If she could get enough people to stay home, the Rajneeshis could flood the ballot box on election day and they could take control of the county. But for that plan to work, they needed more numbers in their favor. And her way of getting more votes in her favor wasn't working. Remember, she'd introduced a share-a-home program to bring in people from all over the country and get them to register to vote in Wasco County. But county officials had successfully challenged these registrations, and the new arrivals were required to appear in person and prove they actually intended to live there, which they couldn't. The plan was a total failure. The Rajneeshis pulled their candidates from the race entirely and announced they'd boycott the election. But the locals weren't taking any chances. On election day in November 1984, Wasco County residents turned up to vote in record numbers, specifically to make sure the Rajneeshis couldn't win. Sheila had poisoned 751 people for no reason. And not only that, but she hadn't gotten away with it as cleanly as she thought. By early 1985, the local congressman, Jim Weaver, was positive that the outbreak was no accident. He'd been getting daily printouts from the investigation, and the more he looked, the less the official story made sense to him. To Weaver, it didn't seem possible that careless cooks had caused something this big and somehow hit that many restaurants in two separate waves. So in February of 1985, he stood up on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives and accused the Rajneeshis of deliberately poisoning the Dalles with salmonella. But he was mostly met with shrugs. Weaver didn't have any hard proof, just the data, his suspicion, and a gut feeling about the timing. The CDC's official findings still pointed at food handlers. So a lot of people figured Weaver was just piling on a group that was already easy to hate, scoring political points off of a community half the state wanted gone anyway. So it seemed like that was that. The restaurants cleaned up and reopened. The people of the Dalles went back to their lives thinking they'd simply lived through a bad run of food poisoning. They had no idea they'd been test subjects in a deliberate attack, or the people responsible were living just up the road. For almost a year, the largest act of bioterrorism in American history was a closed case that nobody even knew was a crime. But the truth was still out there, and it wasn't going to come from an investigation or a congressman or the police. It was going to come from inside the commune itself.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. TNCs apply.
Hi, listeners. It's Vanessa Richardson. On a special 4-episode Conspiracy Theories, Cults, and Crime series, I'm taking you to 4 kinds of dream getaways that went from paradise to deadly. A woman vanishes while snorkeling off Aruba, 2 backpackers murdered on a moonlit beach in Thailand, an NBA champion who disappears off his own catamaran in the South Pacific. These were supposed to be the trips of a lifetime. Listen to our special Deadly Destinations series every Sunday on Conspiracy Theories, Cults, and Crimes. Or if you don't want to wait, all 4 episodes are available right now, ad-free, on Crime House Plus. To join Crime House Plus, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at crimehouseplus.com.
By the summer of 1985, the empire Sheila had built was starting to crumble, and the first crack was at the very top. For more than 3 years, Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh had stayed silent, letting Sheila speak and rule in his name. But in July of 1985, he started to talk again. And almost immediately, he started trying to take back control of his own movement. In one of those first lectures back, he reportedly told his followers that he wouldn't leave them under what he called a fascist regime, a line a lot of people took as a shot directly at Sheila and the way she ran things. But taking back control wouldn't be that easy. The recording of the talk supposedly went missing, written off as damaged by a technical problem before it could circulate. To the people paying attention, it looked like Sheila was trying to bury her boss's own words, because if he started speaking for himself again, it would only be a matter of time before she lost her grip. Sheila's power came from being the gateway to the guru. If Rajneesh was suddenly making his own decisions and listening to other people, then Sheila wasn't the second most powerful person in their world anymore. She was just an employee who'd made a lot of enemies, and she knew it. On September 13th, 1985, Sheila made her move, but she didn't fight, she ran. That day, she and her inner circle abruptly packed up and fled Rajneeshpuram for Europe, ending up in Germany. But Rajneesh wasn't about to let her just slink into the shadows. 3 days later, he did something that stunned everyone. He called a press conference. The man who'd barely spoken in public for years stood in front of reporters and completely threw Sheila under the bus. He accused her and her inner circle of a staggering list of crimes, the poisoning, along with the wiretapping, arson, and attempted murder. Rajneesh said they'd turned his spiritual community into something like a concentration camp. And he backed up his words by inviting the state and federal authorities to come to Rajneeshpuram and investigate for themselves. Now, plenty of people were skeptical, and for good reason. This was the leader of the whole movement, suddenly pinning everything on a woman who just skipped the country right as the law was closing in. For years, he'd been the silent, smiling figure at the center of it all. And now that it was falling apart, he wanted everyone to believe he'd had no idea. But here's the thing, when investigators took him up on the offer, a lot of what he said turned out to be true. In early October of 1985, around 50 investigators moved onto the ranch, expecting to find evidence of wiretapping and immigration crimes. What they actually uncovered was much worse. In the medical clinic, a state scientist found a hidden laboratory containing small glass vials of bacteria. They came back positive for Salmonella, the same strand that had sickened all those people in the Dalles. They also uncovered the wiretapping operation, and the scale of it was staggering. Sheila's people had created an enormous network of bugs and taps across the commune, phones, meeting rooms, the spaces where visitors stayed, even Rajneesh's own private quarters. Almost nothing said at Rajneeshpuram had ever truly been private. Sheila had been listening to all of it. And as investigators dug into the books, the financial picture turned out to be just as rotten. The commune was tens of millions of dollars in debt. But the physical evidence was just the beginning. Because as informants inside the commune started to talk, the rest of it came pouring out. The full scope of what Sheila's circle had been doing was almost hard to believe. And some of the people cooperating had been near the very top. Among them were the former mayor of Rajneeshpuram and one of the lab assistants who'd worked alongside Ma Anand Pooja. These were insiders who had watched it all happen, and now they walked investigators through it. How the Salmonella had been cultured, who'd driven it to the Dalles, how the decisions had been made, and who had made them. The wall of silence Sheila had spent years building came down brick by brick, and it came down from the inside, revealing just how deep Sheila's corruption went. Let's start with the immigration fraud. The whole Rajneesh movement ran on a steady flow of foreign followers, but it was hard to get them into the country with U.S. immigration laws. So Sheila's solution was to manufacture spouses for them. She orchestrated hundreds of fake marriages between American citizens in the commune and overseas followers. She'd pair the people off and coach the couples on how to answer immigration officers so the marriages would hold up. Prosecutors would call it the largest marriage fraud scheme in U.S. history. More than 400 of them. It became the basis of a 35-count federal indictment naming Rajneesh and seven of his top followers, including Sheila. Then there was the arson. It turned out that after the election plot failed, Sheila's people had firebombed a county planning office in the Dalles, seemingly as a way to get the upper hand in their land use fights. As for the attempted murder, it was for trying to kill Rajneesh's own personal physician. At a large public festival on the ranch, a member of Sheila's circle had jabbed the doctor with a syringe loaded with poison. He got so sick that he spent 2 weeks in the hospital, but he survived. Investigators came to believe the motive was that he'd grown too close to Rajneesh and could be a potential rival. And then there was the plot that might be the most chilling of all. Earlier in 1985, Sheila and a handful of her most trusted lieutenants had decided to murder the one man they saw as the biggest threat to their commune, Charles Turner, the U.S. attorney for Oregon, the top federal prosecutor investigating them. Sheila's group included some of the highest-ranking people in the commune, like its chief financial officer and head of security. They drew up a hit list that also included the state's attorney general. One of them bought handguns and even silencers. They obtained fake IDs to make the out-of-state purchases harder to trace. Then they drove to Portland and staked out Turner near his office, studying his routine, figuring out how and where to do it, and one member volunteered to be the one who'd actually pull the trigger. Thankfully, they never got the chance to do it. In the span of a few weeks, the image of Rajneesh Puram had completely inverted. The peaceful desert utopia was now a crime scene tied to a bioterror attack, a wiretapping ring, mass immigration fraud, arson, and a murder conspiracy. By the time it was all cataloged, the crimes traced to the commune's leadership had grown into one of the largest criminal cases in the state's history, with charges eventually reaching more than a dozen of its members, from Sheila down through the lieutenants who'd carried out her orders. The dream was over. All that was left now was the reckoning. With Sheila gone and the investigators swarming the ranch, the walls closed in fast, and not just on her. Rajneesh himself was under federal investigation for the immigration fraud. In fact, a federal grand jury had just handed down a secret 35-count indictment naming him and several followers. He seemed to have known it was coming. His lawyer reportedly called the U.S. attorney that very weekend asking about bail. And then, instead of surrendering, he ran. Or at least he tried to. Late on a Sunday in October of 1985, two chartered Learjets lifted off from the commune's airstrip and headed east, reportedly bound for Bermuda. But federal authorities tracked the planes by radar. When the jets touched down to refuel in Charlotte, North Carolina, U.S. Marshals were waiting. They surrounded the aircraft and arrested Rajneesh and a group of his followers on the tarmac. The man some had called the rich man's guru was led away in handcuffs, thousands of miles from his kingdom in Oregon's high desert. And instead of going to trial, he took a deal. Rajneesh entered what's called an Alford plea, meaning he didn't admit guilt but acknowledged prosecutors had enough evidence to convict. He pleaded to two counts of immigration fraud, fined $400,000, and given a 10-year suspended prison sentence on the condition that he leave the United States and not come back for at least a decade. It's hard to know how much he knew about everything that was going on in his commune, but in the end, it wasn't the bioterror attack or the wiretaps or the murder plot that brought him down. It was paperwork, a pile of fraudulent marriage documents. And in November of 1985, Bhagwan Shri Rajneesh flew back toward India, and the dream of building a holy city in America was finished for good. But he didn't simply go home and disappear. For months, Rajneesh wandered, looking for a country that would take him. One after another, they said no. By some counts, 21 nations refused to let him in. He'd been one of the most magnetic spiritual figures in the world, and now he was a man no one wanted to let through their gate. Eventually, he made his way back to his old ashram in Pune, where he took a new name, Osho. He spent his final years there lecturing again to devoted followers before slipping into silence near the end. He died in 1990 at the age of 58 and was never charged in connection with the poisoning at the Dalles. Until the end, he insisted he'd known nothing about what Sheila had done in his name. And here's something that surprises a lot of people. The movement didn't die with him. That ashram in Pune is still there today, rebranded as a meditation resort, still drawing visitors from around the world. His books and recorded talks, managed now by a foundation based in Switzerland, still sell a lot of copies decades after his death. Even today, many people see him as a genuine spiritual teacher. As for Sheila, she didn't stay free for long. She was arrested in West Germany and in early 1986, extradited back to the United States to face the music. That July, she walked into an Oregon courtroom and pleaded guilty to a list of crimes that included attempted murder, for the poisoning of the two county officials, and for the attack on Rajneesh's doctor, along with assault for the salad bar victims, plus wiretapping, arson, and immigration fraud. The cases had been split between two prosecutors. The U.S. Attorney's Office handled the salad bar poisonings, while the Oregon Attorney General handled the poisoning of the county officials a year earlier. On her way out in handcuffs, Sheila was still smiling. Her explanation for all of it was simple. She said, "My main aim was always to protect Bhagwan." She was sentenced to 20 years in prison and fined $470,000. She only served about 2.5 years, released early for good behavior. Sheila was deported in 1988. The woman behind the largest bioterror attack in American history, along with a plot to assassinate a federal prosecutor, was back out in the world. Her past wasn't entirely behind her, though. In 1999, a Swiss court convicted Sheila of criminal acts connected to that aborted plot to kill the U.S. attorney, although by then she was sentenced to time served. But that didn't mean the authorities were done chasing justice. Sheila's medical director, Pooja, also pleaded guilty, served a short sentence, and then largely vanished from public view. Several members of Sheila's inner circle had scattered overseas, and prosecutors chased them for years. Two of the women involved in the plot to kill Charles Turner were eventually tracked down in England and extradited back to stand trial in the 1990s. The last conspirator wasn't convicted until 2006, more than 20 years after they'd stalked a federal prosecutor through the streets of Portland. As of this recording, Sheila is in her 70s and lives near Basel, Switzerland, where she runs a pair of care homes for the elderly and disabled. She's been the subject of documentaries and interviews, and decades later, she still expresses almost no remorse for what happened in Oregon. As she put it in a recent interview, "I have no explaining to do." And what about the place it all happened? Without Sheila, without Rajneesh, and buried under tens of millions of dollars in debt and a mountain of criminal charges, Rajneesh Puram fell apart almost overnight. By the end of 1985, the city in the desert was effectively done. And for the thousands of ordinary followers, it was a devastating end. These were people who'd sold their homes, handed over their savings, walked away from careers and families, and poured years of their lives into raising a whole city out of the dirt with their own hands. Now, their leaders were criminals or fugitives. The place was a crime scene, and the dream they'd sacrificed everything for was simply gone. A lot of them had nowhere to go and nothing to go back to. They'd been faithful to something they believed was genuinely beautiful, and they were left holding the wreckage. They scattered back to old lives or onto new ones, a lot of them only now learning the full truth of what had been done in their community's name. After the commune collapsed, the ranch eventually reverted to the state of Oregon and was sold off, in part to help satisfy the judgments about Rajneesh, Sheila, and the others. In the early 90s, a Montana family bought the land and donated it to a Christian ministry. Today, that 64,000-acre stretch of the desert, the dam, the buildings, and the land where thousands of red-clad followers once bowed to a passing Rolls-Royce is a summer camp. Looking back at it all now, it seems like a bad dream that a cult of New Age cultists dressed in red could be responsible for the biggest bioterror attack in American history. Maybe since nobody died, it gets overshadowed by events like Jonestown and the Waco siege and Heaven's Gate. But for the 751 people in the Dalles who got poisoned, the fear was very, very real. They were innocent bystanders who got swept up in a cult's cold calculation that their suffering was an acceptable price for political power. Honestly, it's almost a miracle that no one died, because if Sheila had wanted to unleash something much deadlier, she could have. She only decided against it because it wasn't useful to her. That's the real legacy of the Rajneesh movement. It started with a beautiful promise: peace, community, a better way to live. And a lot of genuinely good people believed in it. And in the hands of those at the top, that promise became a justification for poisoning a town, drugging the vulnerable, and plotting to kill anyone who got in the way. The largest biological attack ever carried out on American soil wasn't the work of a foreign enemy or a lone fanatic. It was committed by people who thought they were building heaven on earth. At the end of each episode, I like to take a moment to answer any questions you may have about the case and share my thoughts, so make sure to comment below.
I can't get over the fact that the CDC blamed the cooks. How does the largest bioterror attack in American history get written off as bad hygiene for an entire year?
It's maddening, and it's also weirdly understandable, which is what makes it such a good lesson. Put yourself in investigator's shoes in 1984. You've got a salmonella outbreak. Salmonella is the single most ordinary food bug there is. Most people know the risk of salmonella with raw eggs and undercooked chicken, but lettuce is also a common vehicle for salmonella. I believe they did trace back the lettuce and didn't find anything, but in those days, the only other answer was that if it wasn't the food itself, it must be someone who handled the food. The idea that a religious group, let alone anyone, cultured salmonella, a common and for most part not deadly pathogen, in a lab and deliberately seeded 10 salad bars to rig an election would be crazy. That's not on anyone's list of possibilities because it had literally never happened before in this country. There's also a human factor, one of the investigators admitted to later. With hundreds of people sick, there was huge pressure to give the public a calm answer fast. The cooks were careless, reassures people. You were deliberately poisoned and we don't know by whom, causes panic. So they reached for the explanation that made the fear go away. The takeaway for me is that the most dangerous attacks aren't always the loud, obvious ones. Sometimes the most effective weapon is one that looks exactly like an accident.
The part that gets me is that the attack completely backfired. They poisoned 751 people and still lost.
I would say yes and no. The plan to sway the vote definitely failed. The entire plan was to suppress the vote, to make their opponents too sick to show up so the cult's candidates could win. Instead, the opposite happened. The voter registration scheme got thrown out in court. The Rajneeshis pulled their own candidates. And on election day, the locals turned out in force precisely because they were so alarmed by everything the commune was doing. So Sheila's aggression didn't just fail to win the election. It created a unified, motivated opposition she was terrified of. She manufactured her own defeat. After watching the Wild Wild Country documentary on Netflix, though, I don't think the vote was the only reason Sheila wanted to poison these people. It seemed to me like she also just wanted to harm and punish them for getting in her way. Both of them speak to the hubris and entitlement at the center of this whole story. They were so convinced of their own cleverness, so sure that the normal rules didn't apply to them, that they talked themselves into a biological attack on innocent people, and it didn't even work. It bought them nothing but prison sentences, and there's something almost Shakespearean about that. The scheme to seize power is the exact thing that destroyed them.
Okay, the big one. Rajneesh blamed everything on Sheila and walked away on immigration charges. Do you buy that he didn't know?
This is the question the whole series has been building to, and I don't fully buy it. Could Sheila have run a lot of this day-to-day without looping him in on every detail? Sure. I believe he probably didn't personally approve every vial of salmonella. But I Knew Nothing is a much bigger claim than that. This was his movement. His name was on the town. He lived in the middle of that compound and was driven through it every single day while his followers bowed. The woman doing all of this was his hand-picked secretary, acting in his name, protecting his empire. And remember what he himself said she did. He was the one who stood up and accused her of poisoning and wiretapping and a murder plot. So maybe he was paying so little attention that a bioterror lab and wiretapping ring operated right under his nose without him noticing for years. But the fact that he was aware of these things because he came forward with this information himself, conveniently after Sheila fled the country, maybe him thinking she betrayed him, is questionable to me. Either way, it's not a great look. And one thing I find interesting is the silence. Going quiet for 3 years meant that when it all came apart, every order had come out of someone else's mouth. He built a system where total power flowed to one person and no one could question it. And then when that power was used to commit atrocities, he got to stand in front of the cameras and say, "It wasn't me." Legally, it worked. He was deported on paperwork charges, never tried for the poisoning. But I don't think a leader gets to design a machine like that and then claim he's not responsible for whatever it produces.
Sheila served 2.5 years for a bioterror attack and an assassination plot. How is that even possible?
That fact is still so crazy to me. When you say it out loud, it sounds impossible. A 20-year sentence out in about 30 months. And I think there are a couple of reasons. None of them are very satisfying. One is that nobody died. So legally, these got treated more like serious assault and conspiracy than mass murder. Another is that she cooperated and took a plea, which sped everything up and avoided long trials. But at the end of the day, she poisoned a town and helped plan to murder a federal prosecutor. And she was a free woman before the decade was out. What stays with me the most, though, isn't the sentence, it's her attitude.
Last question, and it's the one I personally keep coming back to. Why isn't this story more famous? This is the biggest bioterror attack in our history, and most people have never heard of it unless they watch the documentary.
It's wild, isn't it? I think a few things buried it. For one, no one died, so it didn't carry the weight of a massacre in the public memory. For another, the whole thing is so strange. A guru, Rolls Royces, free love, salad bars. It was all so out there that it lets people file it under weird instead of terrifying. But I think we should be paying closer attention for a very practical reason. The thing that made this possible wasn't some sophisticated state weapons program. It was a nurse who ordered bacteria from a medical supply company, basically over the counter, and grew it in a clinic. That's it. The barrier to doing real harm was shockingly low, and that should sober all of us up. But if I'm going to leave you with one thought, it's not about Sheila or the guru or the dolls. About 751 people whose only mistake was getting lunch became collateral in someone else's grab for power. We tend to remember the villains in stories like this and forget the people they hurt. I'd ask you to do the opposite. That's where I'll leave it. Thank you for spending these 3 episodes with me. And remember, the people at the center of these cases were never just plot points. They were people. So I'll see you next time. Thanks so much for joining me for this series on the Rajneesh movement. Come back next week for another deep dive into a true crime that changed America. And to enhance your listening experience, join Crime House Plus and get all 3 parts of each week's America's Most Infamous Crime Stories dropped at once every Monday and ad-free. You'll also get the rest of the Crime House lineup ad-free and early, and exclusive bonus episodes. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you listen on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of the America's Most Infamous Crime Show page. Hi, everyone. It's Katie. Before today's episode of America's Most Infamous Crimes, I want to tell you about another show I think you'll love. Crime House and A&E are teaming up on the podcast version of the famous true crime series, The First 48. Each week, Carter Roy takes you inside a landmark homicide case, the interrogations, the dead ends, and the breakthroughs in the critical first 48 hours. Listen to and follow The First 48 every Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.